Welcome to Inspired Money, the live stream podcast featuring inspiring money stories and inspiring lifestyles. Together, we'll learn to make more, give more, and live more. For an interactive experience, join us live at youtube.com/inspiredmoney. Inspired Money is co-created by Runnymede Capital Management and Eagles Vision Creative Collaborative Media Design. We are live in 3, 2, 1.
Aloha, Inspired Money Makers. If you're here for the first time, welcome. If you're returning with us, welcome back to another episode of Inspired Money, the live stream podcast where we invite a panel of experts to help us make the most of our money. I'm your host, Andy Wong, financial advisor. Today, millions of Americans are part of the gig economy, and it's not just in the US. This new work model is growing globally, driven by the demand for flexibility and independence. However, despite its perks, gig work often lacks essential benefits like health insurance and retirement plans. This episode, The Gig Economy, Thriving in the New World of Work, is going to be packed with insights from expert panelists who are going to help us to navigate, succeed, and thrive in the gig economy. Whether you're a seasoned freelancer just starting out or an employer, you'll learn how to make the most of this evolving landscape. This episode is brought to you by my financial advisory firm, Runnymede Capital Management. We help you to plan, invest, and worry less. If you need help with your financial or retirement planning, reach out. I'd love to hear from you. You can send me a message at inspiredmoney.fm/Andy. I'm happy to point you in the right direction. Now, I'm excited about this episode and topic. We're going to get started. I'm thrilled to welcome in our panelists. Let me start with Lewis Hyman. He is Dorothy Ross Professor of History at Johns Hopkins University. Before joining the Johns Hopkins faculty, he was a Newfound Founders Professor of History and Labor Relations at Cornell University. He's the author of 3 books and 2 edited collections on American economic history, most recently Temp, How American Work, American Business, and the American Dream Became Temporary. Currently, his research is on the application of AI to business history archives. Welcome, Lewis.
Thank you so much for having me today.
We also have Jeffrey Moss, founder and CEO of Parker Dewey, a platform that connects companies with highly motivated college students and recent graduates for short-term project-based work. Jeffrey, you have a private equity background focused on education and technology. Can you talk a little bit about how the idea of Parker Dewey's micro-internship platform came about?
Sure. Thanks so much and excited to be here. The idea came about for a couple of reasons. First, as I was getting to know some of these post-secondary students, was realizing that they were smart, hardworking, had great teamwork, great communication skills, all of these core skills companies were looking for, but were getting filtered out of the recruiting process because they didn't have the quote-unquote right academic pedigree, the right school, GPA, major, et cetera. And it seemed like a lost opportunity. And then we started looking at our own recruiting processes, which had the same biases inherently built into them. We were only recruiting from certain schools or only people with certain experiences. And as we saw the emergence of the gig economy back in 2015, and I'm not talking about Uber or DoorDash, but I'm talking about the willingness of companies to allow professional work to get done outside of their four walls, the light bulb went off. Can we create a model that allows companies to recruit college students and for college students to get experience leveraging these short-term projects, these micro-internships, as a pathway to making better hiring decisions and job decisions?
And our third panelist today is Sergio Avedian. He's a seasoned entrepreneur and consultant in the gig economy. He's a senior contributor of The Rideshare Guy and host of the Show Me the Money Club live stream and podcast series. He has extensive experience across platforms like Uber, Lyft, and DoorDash. It's my pleasure to welcome back to Inspired Money. Welcome back, Sergio.
Thank you, Andy. Much appreciated.
So I'm looking forward to this discussion. I think we're going to get lots of different perspectives, right? We have a history professor. We have an individual who is running a gig economy platform. And Sergio He's driven rideshare as well as worked and interviewed a lot of people in the gig economy. So let's jump right in. We're going to go straight into segment one.
The gig economy has revolutionized modern employment, offering flexibility and independence through short-term freelance work. Driven by economic needs and technological advancements, this new work model allows individuals to choose their hours, work locations, and project commitments, providing a better work-life balance. Digital platforms like Upwork, Fiverr, and Uber connect gig workers with clients worldwide, making it easier to find and manage work. Many turn to gig work for additional income or to escape the constraints of traditional employment. For businesses, hiring gig workers means reduced costs and access to specialized skills without the long-term commitment of full-time employees. However, gig workers often lack benefits such as health insurance and retirement plans, raising concerns about worker protections and regulatory frameworks. As technology continues to evolve, the gig economy will expand, driven by the growing demand for flexible work arrangements, offering new opportunities and challenges for both workers and employers.
Louis, if you can kick us off, maybe you can give us some perspective to get started. How do you see the historical evolution of temporary work influencing the current gig economy?
I think that's an essential question, Andy, because, you know, a lot of what we think about the gig economy is really the story of Uber, but it's so much more than that. These kinds of digitally mediated platforms are only a small percentage of the overall ways in which Americans have looked for flexible work outside a traditional 9-to-5. And this has been going on for decades. So in my book, I trace the arc of this, the story of how temp work was invented after World War II, all the way through the current day, ending with the gig economy. And one of the things I try to emphasize is the story of people looking for other kinds of work arrangements and why they look for those kinds of arrangements. So it's not the case that people all had stable, steady work until, you know, the invention of the smartphone. People were already kind of looking for alternatives. And I think they're looking at alternatives both at the top and at the bottom. So people who were left behind by traditional retail were looking for ways to make ends meet. But then there's also the story of people who just were going out on their own as consultants. And I think that is an important story here, that when we think gig worker, we think low pay, but actually there's just as much of a complexity in the gig work economy, the world of 1099s, as there is in W-2s. And so the story of the gig work economy isn't as simple as people might think it would be.
Yeah, so it runs the full spectrum, and I guess it's nothing new, but certainly technology is shaping the way that the gig economy is moving today. Jeffrey, can you talk a little bit about the micro internships helping students and recent graduates to transition from academic life to the professional world? What trends are you observing as far as types of projects that companies are outsourcing or looking for when it comes to hiring shorter term micro internship positions?
Sure. And by the way, completely agree with the prior comment. I mean, technology, gigs have always taken place. Technology has gotten rid of the geographic limitations or connection limitations to make it more accessible. Our whole belief, without opining on the gig economy overall and sort of what's going on there, what we're trying to do is use this acceptance of the gig economy to create pathways to professional employment. So when we talk with college students, what we continue to hear is they want full-time roles. They want traditional employment, especially as they launch their career. But what they're hungry for is the opportunity to determine if it's the right job, the opportunity to demonstrate their skills earlier in the process, the opportunity to not be filtered out based upon academic pedigree. On the employer side, as I alluded to before, they're also seeing opportunities to improve their hiring effectiveness. With 55% of recent college grads leaving their first job in the first year and increasing cost to hire, it's becoming more and more important for companies and for learners to mutually assess fit earlier in the process. So the types of projects the students are doing are not bet-the-company projects. They're not projects that require the deep industry expertise that Louis was talking about before from a 20-year McKinsey consultant, but the types of projects you would give to a new hire, someone out of school, a summer intern, those 10, 20, 30-hour projects that sit on a to-do list that you can give to a college student, yes, as a way to get that project off your to-do list, but also as a more effective way to engage and assess the skills. We all see people with great resumes or who interview really well, but when they start the role, you realize they don't have the right communication skills or problem solving or coachability. These gigs can be used almost like, pardon the metaphor, dates before the engagement of a summer internship and the marriage of a full-time role. And by the way, that metaphor was less creepy when a college student shared it with me as opposed to a 40-something married guy. But it seems to be apropos.
What percentage of the students who take these positions get hired by the company versus use it as a stepping stone?
Yeah, the metric we actually keep track of is 96.1% of students who complete micro internships are professionally employed upon graduation. And while I obviously would love to see that be 100%, it compares very, very favorably to the fact that 47% of recent college grads are under unemployed. Now, we don't expect and we don't want to see 100% of the students do a single micro internship and get hired by that company. We certainly see it quite a bit. And again, a lot of companies are using it as a recruiting tool, but it's also an opportunity to figure out if something's not the right fit. So for instance, we worked with a company that was looking to make 10 full-time hires. They selected 25 micro interns to do the project. Of the 25, 19, they decided they wanted to interview and push down the process. That was okay, because six of the students, again, they realized it wasn't the right fit. Of those 19, they ultimately hired 14. Again, that was a great outcome. They were 40% above their goal, but they also made sure they made the right hires. A year and a half later, by the way, 100% of those students are still there.
Makes a lot of sense. Sergio, from your extensive experience, how has the gig economy evolved in recent years? And what are key factors driving this change?
The gig economy, well, we're the largest channel in the country when it comes to the gig economy with over 300,000 subscribers. And I receive thousands of emails literally every week from all types of gig workers. But as the professor correctly stated, there is a history of this. The gig economy in itself is only a decade, maybe 12 years old, as we know it with Uber, obviously, and Lyft and DoorDash and whatever not. But, it comes with its own set of problems, obviously. And I'm not sure if we can call ourselves gig workers as true independent contractors, just due to the fact that we don't have any pricing power. Now, I give all these companies an immense amount of credit for creating these amazing marketplaces. You know, in a two-sided or a three-sided marketplace, they have this power and the asymmetric information advantage over the consumer and as well as the driver courier groups, right? So, the problems that I see, and I speak to thousands of gig workers every week, there are quite a few, but then, the key concept of this was, there are a lot of independent contractors in this country or self-employed people. There's over 60 million last count that I figured. And they do many different things, right? From plumbers and air conditioning contractors and electricians and whatever they are. But they do have pricing power, right? That's one thing that I'm seeing lately, especially last couple, 3 years, the companies in a rush to become profitable because their growth phases have kind of subsided, but now they're trying to turn profitable. And in a two or three sided marketplace to turn profits, they have to charge as much as they can and they have to pay as little as they can. And earnings have become a major issue for a lot of gig workers.
I want to jump in real quick, and I definitely lean towards the libertarian side, but I actually think they do have pricing power. Again, it's almost inherent in the market economy that if they're not getting paid fairly, they can leave. And there's enough rideshare platforms, just using that as an example out there, that if they don't like the price Uber's paying, they can leave to Lyft. The fact is, I think the gig economy is a perfect example of the market working. I think it's a perfect example of how markets can overcome regulatory burdens. I mean, look at the emergence of Uber. I mean, that was taking advantage of the fact that there was this arcane regulatory infrastructure tied to the medallion system, and Uber created a technological way to improve it. And it allowed individuals to be drivers and use that as an income stream without having to give up such a large percentage of their income to medallions. And if they're not happy with, again, the rev share that Uber's offering or the pricing, they can go elsewhere.
elsewhere is all good. But, you know, as we know, there's a duopoly that exists between Uber and Lyft and rideshare, and obviously DoorDash being the, you know, the top dog in the delivery game. There really isn't that many choices, right? So let's compare, you know, let's say an electrician who's a true independent contractor to a gig worker. You know, the price of the job is set by these companies.
But you're assuming their choices are only driving a car. You're assuming their choices are only Lyft, Uber, or DoorDash. The reality is they could get other hourly jobs. I mean, they're making that choice to drive.
We're definitely talking about gig economy here, right? The gig economy, as we know it, right? It existed before, obviously, as the professor correctly stated, but then it proliferated with Uber, Lyft, and DoorDash coming around. So the gig economy is what it is today because of Uber and Lyft and DoorDash. And then the choices are obvious, right? If you're not profitable, if you're not making any money, if you're not surviving, obviously you can go get a W-2, but we're not talking about that.
Or you can go to TaskRabbit.
Well, absolutely. That's actually what we do on our channel. We try to inform and educate, you know, hundreds of thousands of gig workers, saying that, see, in the old days, about 2015-16, you can literally survive on a single app. These days, we are 100% advising our audience that they have to multi-app. Like, personally speaking, I have 8 apps on my phone. Now, I used to only have one, which was Uber. Now I have 8 apps. So as a true independent contractor that I'm considering myself, I turn them all on, right? And my time is for sale to the highest bidder. I'm basically exchanging my time for dollars. So I turn them all on and I get offers from various ones. And then I jump between one or the other one to make it profitable. But our research indicates that most people's are still on a single app.
Well, and that's why I'm a fan of what you do.
I think we're moving towards a model of a portfolio of work, just like investors have a portfolio of assets. And this is such a huge transformation in thinking. I think that's the technology isn't really the barrier. It's with the way we think about ourselves, and it's the way that businesses think about workers, and it's the way that, you know, we think about where does stability come from in our lives. Is it from one company taking care of us, or is it from the way we can navigate this new world?
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, you know, as big as we are, our reach is, I mean, you know, estimated there's 3-4 million Uber drivers, another million Lyft. Hopefully they are multi-apping, millions of DoorDashers. The point is that a lot of people, right? I mean, we have grown immensely over the last couple of years as a channel, but our reach is only like, I don't know, maybe not even 10%, right? And every time I do speak to a new gig worker, I do see the struggle. Like, they go, oh, I only do DoorDash. I'm like, why are you only doing DoorDash, right? What if it's, you know, not lunch hour or dinner hour, you're not making enough money. You should be doing rideshare in between when people are going from work to home or going out on the weekends and things like that. So to survive in the gig economy today, you must be multi-apping and you must have multiple avenues of earning streams, number one. Number two, there is a thing called deactivation in the gig economy. So everything is run by AI bots, obviously machine learning. And, you know, you're one actually complaint away from getting fired, as they call it. We used to call it getting fired, but now it's called deactivation. And, you know, to get back on these platforms is really, really difficult. So that's why we suggest, hey, you have 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 apps on all at the same time and pick and choose and go between jobs and, you know, be as efficient as you can, optimize that 60 minutes that you're online, right? Not maybe 10 minutes you work for Uber, 15 minutes you work for Lyft, and 20 minutes you work for DoorDash. Well, what you did is your utilization rate is very high and your earnings are going to be very high.
I think in a certain way, Jeffrey and Sergio are talking about the same problem, which is how do you take people that are seen as only useful as drivers and say, hey, you have other abilities? It's the same story for working people as it is for college students. How do you expose those talents? And those talents might not be the ability to program or something like that, but just the ability to show up on time, be reliable. And there's all kinds of ways in which we still haven't fully leveraged all this information about ourselves to find those opportunities.
And by the way, I completely agree. And it's worth separating out. I mean, from an employer's perspective, the guy using employer in quote, there's three very different use cases. Again, there's the case of the DoorDash, Lyft, Uber, where it's simply about a commoditized task, driving me or driving something from one place to another. At the other extreme, it's the Catalan, which formerly was known as Hourly Nerd or even TaskRabbit, where it's more about access to great resources where I don't need someone full time, but I need access to that resource. Again, professional to help me almost as a consultant. And then you have something like Parker Dewey in the middle, where it's not about the gig itself, but the gig is a pathway to something more, a pathway for a company to recruit and for someone to get experience. And all three of those are different. And one of the things that's been really interesting to me, at least in my engagement with the professional employers out there, and again, I'm not talking the Ubers or the gig economy companies, but when we're talking with companies, they're not saying we want to replace our workers with giggers. They are not saying that. They recognize the value of the full-time employee-employer relationship. They're saying, how can we use gig-based work either to solve very concrete, direct, temporary needs, like, again, the Upworks or the Fivers, or how can we use it as a recruiting platform?
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree completely. And the other thing is, like Professor, you know, said, a lot of people are not aware of their capabilities. They really aren't. They think they're just stuck in this box that, I just deliver, I just drive. I mean, no, you have a lot more talent than you think you have. And that's the reach that we're trying to get to, you know, with people saying that this, this is a stepping stone to something better for you. Use the gig economy in general as a stepping stone to your plan B, if you have one, if you want to start a small business, save your money, manage your money, that you're receiving from Uber, Lyft, DoorDash, or whatever other gig apps that you're working on. And use this as a stepping stone to better your life and then to create a career for yourself, let it be, you know, self-employment or, you know, create a small business for yourself. But that's the battle that we're facing quite a bit these days. People are just stuck in a rut. They go like, oh, I only do Uber. I'm like, no, you shouldn't be doing that. You should be using these apps to better your career and create a career for yourself. Because to be perfectly honest, at the moment, from all I see out there, driving for Uber, Lyft, DoorDash is not a career, right? I mean, Uber started with a slogan called, put your side hustle on. I think it's exactly what it is at the moment, right? And to us, even if you have a W-2, right? I mean, look, you know, Andy said a lot of millions of people are joining the gig force. Why? I mean, there's macroeconomic conditions that we can discuss, but that's a different topic altogether. And, you know, people's W-2s due to inflation is just not enough to, right, to pay their bills. So barriers to entry is super easy. You just upload a few documents and within hours you're driving or you're delivering and you're making something to just close the holes that you have in your budget. So, gig work should be at the moment used to as a perfect stepping stone.
And I think just before we move into the next segment, I just want to say one thing to add on what Sergio was saying, which I think is right on, is that for some people, it's a way to close those gaps. It's something they do out of desperation because of the failure of regular jobs at Starbucks, at Walmart, that don't pay people enough, don't give them enough shifts, a way to fill out their time. And then for other people, it's a way to check out something new. So I think there's that variety, that heterogeneity of gig workers that is so important. But it's important that people not be afraid if we want them to really innovate and, you know, contribute to society.
I love the idea that they're, you know, this stability or instability. I mean, if you look back at history, working at one company your entire career and having a pension, like that's one definition of stability. But then today, maybe the future of work, stability means having choices. So we're hearing a lot of different things. And I like the idea that there's entry-level gig work, and then there are higher levels of gig work. So we're going to go there for segment two. Frequently, freelancing tends to be a higher ticket or a higher margin gig economy job. So let's go there, segment two.
To thrive in the gig economy, many successful freelancers create a robust online presence with a professional website and active social media profiles to showcase their work and attract clients. Highlighting unique skills and consistently delivering high-quality work enhances your reputation. Focusing on niche services where demand is high but competition is low allows you to stand out. Stay informed about market trends and adapt your offerings to meet changing needs. Leveraging multiple digital platforms like Upwork, Fiverr, and TaskRabbit increases your visibility and client base. Ensure your profiles are optimized with clear service descriptions, professional photos, and examples of your work. Effective marketing strategies, such as networking and online forums and creating valuable content related to your niche, establish you as an authority. Use productivity tools to manage your time efficiently and maintain a work-life balance to avoid burnout. These strategies help gig workers maximize opportunities and build sustainable careers.
Jeffrey, how important is personal branding for young professionals engaging in micro-internships?
Yeah, I think, again, I sort of get a bit antsy around the term personal branding. I think people think about it the wrong way. One of the things that's been most interesting for me to see is that the employers want to look beyond what would normally be considered part of that personal brand. They want to look beyond where someone went to school or GPA when they're on the Parker Dewey platform. And it was one of the things that was, again, most important to me when we started the company. If we were seeing everyone who was getting selected be the highest GPA or come from the Ivy League schools, I would sort of scratch my head and have some issues with that because that wasn't the goal. The goal was to create these equitable pathways. But one of the things that we found is over 80% of the students selected for the micro internships, so not on the platform, but actually selected, come from populations underrepresented in the workforce. That doesn't include just racial or ethnic diversity, but first-generation college students, non-native English speakers, veterans, adult learners, Pell eligible. So we're seeing these equitable pathways. And what we're finding is these gig-based experiences, these micro-internships, are helping the learners create their personal brand and do so in a way that matters most to employers. So it's been interesting to me watching, again, the discussions around badging and credentialing and certifications and the like, over the past 10 years and some of the challenges with getting traction in that space. What we found is we're empowering the student to generate a series of experiences that they can put on their resumes and help employers evaluate their skills, whether they did a micro internship for them or a different company. It provides a way for the employer to evaluate the skills and make hiring decisions with better, more predictive information as opposed to relying on the non-predictive signal of GPA major in school.
Jeffrey, is it really an updated, instead of a corporation reaching out to different temp agencies, being able to have a single platform?
Not really, because again, this isn't about someone being out for maternity and needing someone to sit at the front desk or file, or we need an experienced accountant to help us during busy season. Companies are really using this as a key part of their recruiting tool. So I'm going to a career fair, but maybe I don't have the brand recognition of some of the other companies. Well, let's offer micro internships as a way to drive students to our booth or as a way to keep those students warm within our recruiting funnel. Or maybe there's certain schools we can't visit, so we don't, again, have access to the students. Let's use micro internships as a way to engage those students. And then again, it's the whole concept of this gig as a pathway. So the gig itself, the individual project is great and certainly provides value, but unlike the temp workers, they're really using this as a way to, for lack of a better term, audition potential candidates mm-hmm. to see their skills beyond what you could find from a resume or even an interview.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. Very practical. Sergio, you mentioned having so many apps on your phone. Like, how does one stand out and succeed on multiple platforms? Like, what can you do? What can a gig worker do to stand out?
Not much. I mean, look, I have a relationship with all these companies. I've interviewed all their CEOs actually on our channel. I call it the way I see it. And the companies could do a lot more, right? But then as a gig worker, you're just a number to these companies, and there are massive, massive algorithms that are running in the background. Who gets what order, what trip, matching systems. There's very complex things. They have made the back end of the business very complex, although on our end, on the gig worker's end, it's pretty simple. You pick up point A, drop off point B. It seems very simple, right? But it's really not. On the back end, there is a lot that's going on as far as incentives and things like that. So for you to stand out as a gig worker to any of these companies, you just got to be playing their game correctly. I mean, it's a gamified system and you have to play the game correctly. And that's what we try to do on the channel. You know, we try to tell people, I mean, there is, we call something called 3 P's, right? 3 P's are You have to be patient, right? You have to position yourself correctly. And then let's say if you're doing deliveries, well, you want to be near a row of restaurants so you can get an order quicker, right? I mean, there's certain common sense things, but then you have to have certain strategies involved to stand out actually from the gig worker or a Uber driver or a Lyft driver or a DoorDasher to actually increase your earnings. I mean, there are ways to do it. And we have done our surveys, many of them. And to stand out, this is how you do it, right? You use a little bit of strategy, use a little bit of common sense. And we've noticed that in the same city, during the same hour, the bottom 10% of drivers, as far as earnings are concerned, versus the top 10% of drivers, is close to 3x. We're doing the exact same thing. How am I standing out over the guy that's just making nothing versus me making 3x of what he's doing? So, you know, as far as standing out, you have to, you have to use some strategy. You can't just willy-nilly turn the app on and go out there and say, feed me. I mean, it's just not going to work that way.
Okay. Lewis, your thoughts?
I mean, I just keep thinking about, you know, how different the pictures are in that video you showed us than an Uber driver. They're all people sitting in cafes, working at their laptops, creating content and doing video editing. And these are technical skills. They are not interchangeable people. They have unique perspectives on how to accomplish these creative tasks. And this is very different than interchangeable workers who are, you know, basically treated as commodities that are just driving a person from point A to point B. And I think it's very hard to raise the price of that as opposed to some sort of individual differentiator. So I think as we talk about this, it's a very big difference between what's going on Upwork than what's going on Uber. And I think that, you know, part of the conversation has to be, well, how many people are in this one part? How many people are in another part? I'm part of a group that runs the Gig Economy Data Hub that tries to center this kind of information to have a sense of, well, what does the landscape look like? Because it's just as important that we support those new opportunities for well-paid work that are, you know, independent and self-driven, as well as support people who are in these commodity jobs. But by lumping them together as gig economy, we miss a lot of the complexity.
Okay, so it sounds like certain things, like certain ride-sharing platforms, may have a low barrier to entry. As long as you have a driver's license and can drive, yep, you can participate. But yep, then maybe it takes a mindset of trying to figure out, like, how can you be continuously learning? And what skills can you develop so that you can offer different types of gig work? How important is that? Like,
I mean, look, Andy, as a rideshare driver, let's say you can start as a rideshare driver, right? You learn your city, you learn the flow, you learn the rhythm of your city. I mean, you're dealing with 20, 30 passengers at a time, right? Okay, so you do that for a couple of years, you save your money. And then now you're thinking, okay, well, why don't I get into some sort of private rides, right? For higher end clientele. Maybe you can move up and buy a better car or buy an SUV and offer some limo services or offer private trips with obviously correct insurance and LLCs and all that stuff. So even as an Uber driver, you have to think, you know, how do I improve myself, right? Am I going to just keep driving people from point A to point B? Or can I do within the same industry, can I do something different? Right, with a little bit of capital spent, I can improve my earnings. I can improve everything that I'm doing. I mean, you don't have to jump from industry to industry, but like the professor said, you know, these low barrier entry jobs, you know, starter jobs, let's say the Uber drivers, Lyft drivers, DoorDashers, that's the dilemma that we're facing, that people are just thinking this is all I can do. No, earn your money, do that job for a while, but then, you know, all the other platforms like TaskRabbits and Work, you know, Fiverr and you know, Upwork, you know, these people have more specialized skills, right? So while you're doing the low-end gig work, you know, acquire yourself those specialized skills and then move up as well if you want to stay in the gig economy. So, you know, that's the message that we're trying to put out constantly.
Jeffrey, did you have anything to add? I mean, it sounds like, how does someone get to the point where they're using your platform so that it 1099 to become a W-2.
Yeah, I agree. And again, I go back to Professor Hyman's point where I think one of the biggest challenges with the gig economy is everything is getting lumped together and they're materially different. Again, we need to separate out the commoditized services like driving me from point A to point B from the more professional or specialized or individual skilled services. As far as the Parker Dewey platform, I can tell you again, maybe not 100%, but certainly close to 100% of the individuals who are on our platform, whether they are current college students, whether they're getting certificates from programs like IBM Skills Build, whether they're factory workers at Amazon who are part of the Career Choice Program, almost 100% of them are looking to become W-2 workers. And they're on Parker Dewey, not for the side income. That's secondary. And we've actually surveyed the individuals on the Parker Dewey platform. Getting paid is vital because it ensures these experiences are accessible to everyone, but that's not why they're doing it. They're doing it because they want the experience and they want the career exploration and they want to reinforce the learning they're getting both in and out of the classroom. So they're using it as that pathway.
I think one of the problems in our economy today is that we have very few signals about potential hires. And one of the things we look to is GPA as a signal of do they show up and do they work hard? But of course, school isn't for everybody. I say this as a professor. But that kind of do they show up and do they work hard is true for people who, you know, pick vegetables all day. They work much harder than I do, and they show up much better than I do. And that kind of behavioral signal is actually probably more important to many businesses than whether or not you're good at a calculus test. And I think one of the tragedies in our economy today is we have no signal for behavior. And that's certainly what a lot of businesses are looking for. People that are good with other people, people that show up, take responsibility for their actions. And none of this is taught in school. So
Professor Hyman. Oh, sorry.
Sorry, please.
No, I thought you were done. Go ahead, please.
I am done. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yes. 100%. I could not agree with you any more fully. Again, all of these companies talk about skills-based hiring like it's something new. The reality is we've always hired experienced professionals using skills-based hiring because we have data points beyond academic pedigree. We could talk about their prior experiences. We can look at what they accomplished. We could see those skills that we know are most valuable from real experiences. At the early career, the only signals that exist are, again, academic pedigree. That's what we're trying to do, is empower these individuals to have more signals that they can share with the employer. The one thing I would take issue with, Professor Hyman, is I actually think things like communication and problem solving, coachability, et cetera, are taught in school. And they're taught irrespective of if you're a finance major versus a philosophy or history major. Part of what we're trying to do is empower these individuals to recognize that as a philosophy major, I learned things like how to communicate, how to craft an argument. As a student athlete, I learned to demonstrate things like coachability. Helping these learners understand and appreciate those skills learned in classes that don't sound like job titles, and helping employers look beyond academic pedigree to understand that I want someone with strong communication skills, I can look beyond the marketing major.
Yeah, I mean,
sorry, I think school still matters. I'm glad to hear that. Yeah.
If I may add to what Jeffrey said, I mean, you know, a lot of people think it's a commoditized business, right? I mean, as far as a rideshare driver or a delivery driver. But we are in touch with people all day long, right? So we can improve our own communication skills. And we're dealing with 20, 30 passengers or 20, 30 food pickups. You're dealing with the front office or front of the restaurant. Then you're dealing with a customer, right? And then you're dealing with rideshare trips, people going to airports. You know, you can create better communication skills. You can improve your skill set by just doing those if you are lacking. You know, academics is obviously wonderful, but it, like Professor said, is not for everyone. And, you know, then you can go land a job with more better skill set. I mean, you're literally communicating. If you're a driver, if you're driving Uber for 10 hours, you have 30 people in your car, all 30 are different, right? You have to be able to read the room and you have to be able to cater and service, you know, the rider as well as you can. And you do learn. You're constantly learning, even when you're doing these entry-level jobs, gig jobs.
I think it's worth...
Sergio, I completely agree with you. And again, I hope I didn't offend you by talking about Uber or Lyft being commoditized, because I think it's worth thinking through. It might be commoditized to me as the customer. As long as someone gets me from point A to point B, I am happy. Maybe there's a little bit of nuance in how they get me there and the level of communication. But to your point, I love the fact that you're empowering the individual driver to take ownership of his or her career and think about how those skills they're learning as an Uber driver, DoorDash delivery person, et cetera, can be applied as they think about longer term, more financially rewarding careers.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, there's a stigma attached, right? I mean, they go like, oh, you're just an Uber driver. Well, I'm an Uber driver, right? And to me is you know, I think it's kind of an unfair situation just because it's an entry-level job, you're just an Uber driver. I mean, we have a community truly super educated. I mean, I was just talking to a gentleman who's going through a PhD program and is driving Uber, right? So to us, you know, it's not what you know, right? It's who you are, how you present yourself. Why does one driver get 60% of the time tips while the other one doesn't? Because he has better communication skills, right? Mm-hmm. So you can improve all these things even with an entry-level job or entry-level gig work like Uber and Lyft and DoorDash are.
Yeah, one thing that I want to say is that we didn't go in this direction, but it's worth thinking about because I've been spending a lot of time on LinkedIn lately. So shout out to our LinkedIn Live viewers. I see a lot of people who spent most of their career in corporate America. And then either because of a layoff or because they decide to go off on their own, they've seen opportunities where the gig economy gives them tremendous benefit. That yeah. Whereas they were working for a company and felt constrained under a manager that they had difficulty with or just weren't getting promoted, suddenly they could take their skill and go off on their own, hang their own shingle, and do so with a lot of independence and flexibility. Right. I want to move to segment three. We're going to talk about navigating the uncertainties of the gig worker.
Effective financial planning can provide much needed stability for gig workers who may face irregular income streams. Start by creating a detailed budget that covers essential expenses like rent, utilities, and groceries. Use budgeting tools to track your income and expenses. Building an emergency fund is crucial. Aim to save 3 to 6 months worth of living expenses in a separate account, contributing regularly until it's well-funded. Managing taxes is also important. Use accounting software to track income and expenses, set aside a portion of each payment for taxes, and consult a tax professional to maximize deductions. For retirement, explore options like IRAs or solo 401ks and contribute consistently. A financial advisor can help tailor a retirement strategy to your needs. Additionally, research affordable health insurance through marketplace exchanges or professional organizations, and invest in health and disability insurance for protection against unexpected medical expenses. Diversifying income sources by exploring different gig platforms and targeting various client niches can provide stability even during slow periods. These strategies help gig workers manage financial uncertainties and secure their futures.
Lewis, what lessons can gig workers learn from financial challenges faced by temporary workers in the past?
Well, I think part of it is the story of income volatility. So in this country, we talk a lot about income inequality, which is a huge problem, but we talk much less about income volatility. And I think for a lot of gig workers, that's where the challenge is, which is that, you know, from month to month, you may not get all the shifts you want at your regular job, and you're trying to stabilize that flow of money. So how do you budget? I mean, it's all well and good to say budget, but how do you budget if your income is swinging by 30% in a month, as it is for the median household income? So I think one of the things to think about this in terms of the history of temp workers is trying to think of it as a buffer against that volatility. And that historically, it was the case that temp work was linked to a two-person stable married household. And of course, that's really no longer the case for, you know, so many Americans having that backup. And so you have one earner in a household and they're faced by all this volatility. So these kinds of ideas seem very straightforward to people who have salaries. And for people who don't have salaries, it's much harder to achieve.
Yeah, it sounds like when there's uncertainty, you need to sock away extra so that you have some cushion. Sergio, you've talked about how the algorithms change and how different platforms change. There are periods where there are a lot of incentives where you get paid more. And you can make more money, and then suddenly the algorithm changes and it becomes more competitive and it maybe payouts are less. What financial planning advice do you have for gig workers who experience the irregularity in income streams?
Yeah, I love this segment. Actually, this is when we first started Show Me the Money Club a couple of years ago on our channel. You know, one of our first segments or episodes was about, do you know your cost per mile? Right? Because we've interviewed the CEOs, obviously, and when we interviewed the CEO of Uber, he said, you have to treat this as your small business, right? I mean, there's revenue, and then there's your cost, and you have to figure out your profitability. So we thought it would be a boring subject, okay? Well, surprise, surprise, it wasn't, because nobody knew what their cost per mile was. So we created spreadsheets. We're trying to financially educate drivers of, listen, what you're earning, what's hitting your bank account is not what you're making. Like, people go, I made $1,000 this week. Well, you didn't make anything. There is a cost of getting that $1,000 into your bank, right? You have variable costs, you have fixed costs. So we got into this, and then every month, a specific show we do just to talk about these things. In fact, a couple of months ago, we started talking about creating SEP IRAs, creating, you know, all these financial tools that gig workers somehow are neglecting. I don't know why, because most of them, right, don't save any money. They just spend everything, right? We started talking about investing. Without giving advice, obviously, but we need to educate the community, massive gig worker community, that you have other choices, right? You have to think about this. You are your own business. You have to take care of your retirement plan. I mean, you may be young today, but then, you know, we're all going to get old, right? Father time is not going to wait for anyone. So, you know, I think this is what the number one issue is in the gig economy these days, that there is not enough education. Although, you know, a lot of people do this on a transitory basis, right? You know, you do it for 6-8 months while you're between W-2s or whatever. But there are a lot of people who do this full time and they don't think of the future. They don't think of, well, what if my car breaks down? Do I have enough money to fix this thing? Do I have a rainy day fund, right? Even the simplest things. So, you know, we're doing our best, and I think we're getting traction because we're opening people's eyes, or gig workers saying that, you know, there is a better way of doing this, right? Instead of me going out and blowing $100 at a movie theater one night with my DoorDash earnings, maybe I'll just put that in some sort of a retirement account or open myself a brokerage account and do dollar cost averaging into some ETFs, right? So to me, that's the most important thing that I'm trying to do. Just educate, educate, educate. And then look, we're all adults. People got to do what they got to do. I can't force them. But I think it's sorely lacking. And, you know, a lot of people blame the companies. They go, well, the companies aren't doing it. Well, that's not the company's job. It's an individual choice. I mean, you either want to save or you don't want to save, right? So, I'm very passionate about this. I think gig workers should think for the longer term and should really take advantage of what they're doing now and then create some sort of retirement for themselves.
I think especially for drivers, it's better so much. When I talk to Uber drivers, I mean, I'm sure everyone talks to whoever they're driving with, how few actually calculate depreciation on their cars.
Yeah.
And how important depreciation is to making it a viable job. And I think it does take extra work to be an independent contractor in terms of keeping track of all those costs. And it'd be great if we could figure out a way to make it easier to get that information from the platforms and for gig workers to account for all those real costs that they are should be subtracting off their taxes.
I mean, to be fair, there are companies out there that do that. Like, there are companies like Gridwise, Solo, mileage tracking apps, right? All these tools are out there. It's just a matter of, you know, acceptance of these tools and gig worker using it, right? And to me, you know, we have affiliate relationships with a lot of these companies and they don't use them. I'm like, buddy, this is figuring out your taxes. This is figuring out your mileage deduction. This is figuring out everything for you. Go do it, right? And then they go, I don't want to pay $5 for that app a month. I'm like,
and Sergio, love the fact
you have to think about these things.
And Sergio, I love the fact that not only are you mentioning the tools, but you're highlighting the fact it's up to the individual. These are grown adults. These are people that need to take ownership. So as opposed to, and again, sorry, professor, as opposed to saying it's the responsibility of Uber, Lyft, or DoorDash to provide these tools, That's not their job. They're creating a platform allowing Jeff, the driver, to sort of find rides and deliver them. Let Jeff take ownership of, again, how he's going to keep track of that mileage or data. Let's put the responsibility on the individual.
Yeah, 100% agree. And you know, we even did spreadsheets. We did, you know, live links like a Google Sheets docs. So you can put your variables and fixed costs in there, and then it'll spit out what your cost per mile is. Because like the professor said, people didn't even know what depreciation was. I mean, if you're driving a new car, obviously the depreciation is going to be a lot higher on that, because as an average, I don't know, Uber driver, you're driving 5,000-6,000 miles a month, right? At the end of the year with 70,000 miles on your 2023 Toyota, right? How much of that did you eat, right? And then, but then, you know, people just don't understand these things. And to me, that's the most important thing I can do. I mean, I can bitch and moan about the companies doing this, doing that. But I think as you have to take ownership, like Jeffy says. And these tools are out there. It's not like you have to create this like 20 column spreadsheets and get into any of this stuff. All you have to do is plug in your numbers. You buy gas, you plug it in. You buy your car, your note, your whatever it is. And then now you'll have an idea of, okay, wait a minute. You know, $1,500 this week hit my bank account from Uber. But then once I plug everything in, that $1,500 is not really $1,500, right? So, I think this is the most important topic out of all three. I mean, people need to understand there's a cost of doing business. Treat this as your own small business as long as you're doing it.
There's that. And I think that there are a lot of pros to the gig economy, but one con is that you have to be self-reliant. It's kind of like the pension fund where, you know, the company took care of you in retirement, and now you have a 401k plan and you're in charge of your destiny. You better select your funds. You better educate yourself. And in the gig economy, you have to be self-reliant. You have to take care of yourself.
Real quick, I would argue that should be true of any employee. Whether you're a 1099 or W-2, you need to take individual responsibility. We are in an environment where people can change jobs really easily. If they're not happy with their healthcare plan, if they're not happy with their company's 401k, they're not happy with their salary or role, they need to take that individual responsibility. And again, saying that that's a difference between gig economy and employees, I think is a little bit of a misnomer.
Yep, well said. Let's go to segment 4.
Navigating legal rights and protections is crucial for gig workers. Classified as independent contractors, many gig workers miss out on benefits like minimum wage and health insurance. This classification has led to legal battles, with workers seeking reclassification for better protections. In the U.S., new rules could expand protections for gig workers under the Fair Labor Standards Act. Europe is moving towards classifying more gig workers as employees, granting them greater legal protections. In Canada, provinces like British Columbia and Ontario are introducing laws to ensure gig workers receive basic employment standards, such as minimum wage and dispute resolution. India's new labor codes aim to extend social security benefits to gig workers, though enforcement remains a challenge. As regulations evolve, gig workers must stay informed about their rights and the protections available to them. Understanding these changes empowers gig workers to advocate for fair treatment and secure better working conditions.
Jeffrey, I think that you sit in a unique spot, you know, being able to see a platform like Parker Dewey. Do you see that there are changes necessary in labor laws to protect gig workers, particularly young professionals and recent graduates?
Honestly, not really. I think some of the laws are actually overreaching. So I think about things that we've done on our platform. And again, we say everything very, very not even close to the line around the labor laws around gig economy. But I think about certain places where it certainly makes it more difficult or more risky. So for instance, there's companies we work with that may be located in California that just automatically assume they can't offer micro internships on Parker Dewey because of California gig economy laws. Now, first of all, that's false. And there's ways that we help them understand. But that bias, because of the laws and regulations and noise around it, creates friction. Because at the end of the day, what those laws are doing is they're preventing opportunities for college students to get real experiences with real companies. And back to my earlier comment, with 80% of them being individuals from backgrounds underrepresented in the workforce, these labor laws and these regulations and these proposals about additional regulation on the gig economy is having this unintended consequence of it's actually hurting these college students' abilities to get full-time roles. So again, like any regulation, as I said, I definitely lean towards the libertarian side. You're creating these unintended consequences of making it difficult for college kids to get these experiences that they're hungry for. And just to be clear, 100% of the projects, the micro-internships on Parker Dewey are paid and paid fairly. On average, while everything is project-based, when we've actually looked at actual time spent by students, on average, it's north of $25 an hour is what these students are making. That's more than they would be making in their part-time jobs on campus. And that is ignoring the fact that they're building their resume and getting hired for full-time professional roles at a higher rate than college students overall.
Yeah, that's a great value add. Sergio, you're on the front line. What legal challenges do you see gig workers commonly face?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we know what's been what happened this year already, right? We know what happened with the Department of Labor saying one thing. What I've discovered is this, right? Because I do a lot of consulting with startups and, you know, even with legislators. I mean, legislators may have a good idea, okay, about unionizing drivers or gig workers or this or that, right? Well, we do our surveys literally every 6 months on the rideshare guy, and we get our sample size is not that small, right? I mean, we get tens of thousands of responses to these surveys. One of the surveys that we did I think it was last month, was, you know, we asked, do you want to become an employee or do you want to become you want to stay an independent contractor, right? Overwhelmingly, 80% plus said, for one reason or another, they wanted to stay independent contractor. And as we know, Uber, Lyft, DoorDash, their business model with their zero asset or low asset business models, they cannot just overnight accept, you know, 6, 8, 10 million employees, right? It's just not going to happen. These companies will go broke. So, but one thing that I notice about the law and legislation and being involved with Proposition 22 in California before that AB 5, and now with what happened in Massachusetts, right? There were 5 propositions on the ballot going into the elections. The state AG and Uber and Lyft agreed, you know, they set up these hybrid plans. There's hybrid with portable benefit plans, right? Companies cannot afford to have employees. I mean, this is it. This is the way gig work is set up. And the community is saying that, right? They want to stay independent contractors. But I think what Jeffrey said is correct. There is, you know, certain legislative groups have this opinion that, yeah, everybody should be employees of these companies. Well, the jobs are going to disappear if they do, because the other thing that's going to happen is that, just like it's happening in New York City now, these companies own the apps, right? If you want to become an employee of this company, they're going to put a schedule on you. They're going to give you an Uber hat and say, you go out and drive, you accept every trip, you can't turn down trips, this is your shift. It's just like regular things. So, and a lot of the legislators, I think, are misinformed. They may have good intentions in what they're trying to do, but then they don't know the consequences of these actions that they're taking. And actually, that's the other thing I'm trying to do, just, you know, talk to as many legislators as I can before they pass something that Uber, with their heavy lobbying power, is going to go absolutely decimate and kill, right? So, you know, they're trying to help the gig worker, but they're kind of hurting the gig worker with some draconian, you know, laws that they're trying to pass. So.
Yeah, it's not easy. Lewis, any history lessons that we can learn from labor laws?
I mean, partially it's that the labor laws are history, right? They come from a particular moment in the 1930s, the 1940s, the 1950s, when Americans were looking to a steady work industrial economy, a 9-to-5 permanent job. And I think for a lot of people, they look to that as an era of good work. But it was also part of a particular kind of economy. And I think today, instead of listening to Sergio, listening to workers and saying, well, what do you want? What do you need? People who are well-intentioned, as he said, want to shoehorn the gig workers back into what they consider to be the good economy. Instead of saying, well, how do we combine stability and flexibility? How do we create the opportunity for reasonable wages in a range of flexible work. And for me, I think this is the great tragedy that you are trying by these kinds of regulations. It's going to crush the markets in certain places where people need these jobs. They need these jobs to fill out their schedule. They need these jobs because the W-2 economy has already failed them, right? So the idea that somehow if you got a W-2, suddenly everything would be great. Well, that's obviously not the case because there was inequality and instability for American workers long before there was Uber and the so-called gig economy.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with the professor. I mean, you know, in the previous segment, he said it, right? Today's W-2 is nothing like the W-2 of 30 years ago where you worked there and got a gold watch and left with retirement. It's not like that. People switch jobs like socks these days. So to me, you know, gig work has its place. Yes, there is some certain protections that are needed for the drivers, such as safety issues, you know, many things that we can discuss. However,
yes,
all the intent of the legislators just lumping everybody in like a bucket, I think is wrong.
Well, let's everybody stay tuned because we're going to ask the panelists where they think the gig economy is going. Let's bring it home with our last segment.
The gig economy is evolving rapidly with significant transformations ahead. Technological advancements like AI are revolutionizing job matching, making it easier for gig workers to find suitable opportunities quickly. Blockchain can enhance transaction transparency and security, which is crucial for contract enforcement and payment systems. New hybrid work models are emerging, blending traditional employment with gig work. This allows businesses to maintain a core team while using gig workers for specialized tasks. Additionally, the gig economy is expanding into sectors like healthcare, finance, and education. Legislative changes that provide gig workers with benefits such as health insurance and retirement plans aim to balance the flexibility of gig work with the security of traditional employment. Globalization and remote work are further breaking down geographical barriers, allowing gig workers to access opportunities worldwide. Continuous skill development through online courses and certifications is becoming essential for staying competitive. These trends are shaping a dynamic future for the gig economy, offering both challenges and opportunities.
Lewis, I know you do a lot of research on AI. How do you think AI is going to impact the future of work?
Well, I'm a huge booster of AI. I think it's a complement, not a substitute technology. I use it all day long, and it allows me to do things I could never do. But I also don't think it replaces me. In fact, I think it clarifies what is useful about being human. And I think in the era of AI, we need to lean into that. We need to lean into showing people how to be responsible, how to be curious, things that were, you know, beaten out of us in the industrial era, things that we don't value as a society anymore. And I think AI has this ability because it requires a person to be managing it, to make it accomplish useful tasks, to really raise up the, you know, marginal productivity of all laborers. And I think the more we can do that to teach people how to use these tools, the more valuable they'll be in the marketplace for businesses. So I think we're on the cusp of something really wonderful if we don't, you know, stifle it or squash it.
Jeffrey, I want to ask you about Parker Dewey. Like, how do you prepare for opportunities for gig workers in emerging industries? How do you prepare them for that?
Yeah, I mean, my general view is that even with emerging industries, the same core skills are required as traditional ones. And I'm not talking, again, industrial revolution or whatnot. I'm talking the fact that AI is becoming more top of mind. Great. I, as a college student, still need to learn how to harness technology and program in more languages or leverage tech tools in the same way that 10 years ago, the college student needed to learn how to use the internet. The same way 20 years ago, the college student needed to learn how to use personal computing. So I think a lot of it is noise, that by teaching individuals these same core skills, again, communication, problem solving, learning how to learn, adaptability, they'll be just as prepared for the emergence of AI and whatever new tools come as they were for the emergence of the internet and whatnot.
Sergio, Do you think about emerging technologies, like how AI will continue to impact the gig economy, or maybe even will blockchain have an impact?
Yeah. And in fact, you mentioned blockchain. I'm going to interview the CEO of a platform that's being developed on the Solana blockchain. You know, Paul Bohm, he's the CEO of Teleport, and he's going to revolutionize, right? So I'm very fascinated, obviously, by AI and machine learning, because these companies, you know, they're not shy about it. I mean, all the gig companies, they absolutely use AI and machine learning and you know, all these tools to, from matching systems to pricing systems to, obviously, to increase their margins, because like Uber's earnings came out yesterday. They did 2.8 billion trips in one single quarter. Right? That's over 1.2 million trips per hour, 24/7, 365. Okay. Well, without AI, without machine learning, without any of that, how the pricing works on this, on the rider end, the driver end, of course, you know, they use it heavily. And I'm in agreement with the professor. I think I use AI quite a bit myself. I mean, you know, we create content, tons of content, and it is helping us to create better content, actually. So, to me, you know, don't shy away from it. Hopefully it goes the right direction. But as far as gig work is not going anywhere, right? The total addressable market in gig work on the platform side for them, their TAM is massive. They're probably only maybe 20-25% of TAM, right? The projections are going forward is just incredible. And then same thing with the gig worker. I mean, they're, you know, we're not going anywhere. But, you know, ultimately, though, for all of you, right? We all are consumers, right? We push a button, a car shows up. We push a button, you know, food shows up or groceries show up. But then we also always have to think a human has to do this work until autonomous vehicles take everything over, self-driving takes everything over, robots are bringing you the food. And that's down the road. And that's when AI actually may hurt the gig worker, because obviously they're going to do the work a lot cheaper and a lot better, show up on time, not complain, and any of that stuff. So, you know, it's an interesting topic, though, going forward. I'm going to just end it with time will tell how AI is going to affect the gig worker.
Thank you. Jeffrey, final thought?
Yeah, I think this whole separating out the gig economy from the regular economy is a little bit mixed. Again, the gig economy is just giving different ways for individuals to, whether it's get experience or generate income or any combination thereof, and for companies or organizations or individuals to leverage labor in different ways. Again, if they need just someone for temporary help, they're no longer limited by just going to a McKinsey or a Bain or a BCG. And if they're trying to recruit talent, they're no longer limited to just job boards or career fairs. So I think it's sort of an interesting overarching. I agree with Sergio that it's going to continue to grow. I'm really interested to watch it. I'm really interested to see how regulation impacts it. Again, like any regulation, I think it certainly has created unintended consequences, some of which we discussed before. I think it's created market inefficiencies, and it'll be interesting to see how well the government sort of adjusts to understanding where the gig economy fits in a way that creates positive outcomes for all of the stakeholders.
Thank you. Lewis, final thought?
I just really enjoyed this conversation. I think it's much more complicated and nuanced than you normally hear in the gig economy. And I'm excited that we're having this conversation.
Well, thank you to all of our panelists for the very thoughtful conversation. One big takeaway for me is that the gig economy is so diverse and I guess covers such a wide spectrum that you really do have to think about what marketable skill do you have or want to develop? So as a homework assignment for you, just take the first step in enhancing your gig economy journey. Think about what is that skill that you can monetize and use as your career. That can include updating your online profiles and researching gig platforms, maybe setting up a budget to manage your finances. But choose one actionable task and commit to completing that task this week. Don't forget to share your progress with us on social media. You can use the hashtag #InspiredMoney. We'd love to hear how you're applying what you've learned today. Thank you for joining us. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe, rate, and leave us a review. I encourage everyone to visit and follow our guests. Lewis Hyman is history professor at Johns Hopkins University. You can find him at lewishyman.com. Jeffrey Moss is the founder and CEO of Parker Dewey, which you've learned all about today. You can find him at parkerdewey.com. And Sergio Avedian, senior contributor for the Rideshare Guy, host of the SMTMC live stream and podcast series. Find him at therideshareguy.com or sergioavedian.com. Thank you, everyone. Thanks to the panelists. Be sure to join us next week on August 14th. We're going to be talking about the rise of women in finance, empowering financial independence. I'm Andy Wong. This is Inspired Money. Until next time, do something that scares you, because that's where the magic happens. Thanks, everyone.